Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to the Chemistry World Podcast, episode number 4, with Chemistry World's editor, Mark Peplow.
Hello.
With science correspondents, Victoria Gill.
Hello.
And Richard Van Norden.
Hello.
And with me, Chris Smith. This month, how there's a fortune in precious metals and concentrated ores lurking on the seabed.
There's a lot of secrets in the deep ocean that we're just beginning to understand, and one of these is the hot springs on the deep ocean floor that are spewing out fluids at temperatures as high as 420 degrees centigrade. And in these fluids are dissolved metals, iron, copper, zinc.
Steve Scott will be exploring the feasibility of harvesting hydrothermal vents very shortly. Also, the washing machine that's got the US's Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, all in a spin.
The saga begins when a Samsung washing machine, which released silver ions into your clothes to kill bacteria, was classed as a pesticide by the EPA. These silver ions could accumulate in wastewater treatment plants, might possibly kill bacteria that were meant to treat the wastewater.
And deferring to DEFRA, how a trial to size up the risk of organophosphate exposure amongst farmers could be back on track. Or is it?
Although DEFRA have agreed to continue funding us, they've said that we have to write a report finding an alternative control group from the one that we originally suggested and making a very strong argument for why it's suitable.
That's all on the way. But first, cast your mind back to the Christmas festivities and Mary's chemical conundrum from the December Chemistry World podcast.
When Christmas crackers were invented, what made them go bang?
Any ideas? Well, keep listening to find out if you're right later in this programme. Now, first this week, Mark's getting straight to the heart of the matter with a look at a way to use cardiac cells to pump fluids around labs on chips.
Yeah, that's right. Normally, when you have miniaturised labs on chips, you use conventional electrically powered pumps to move fluid around tiny channels to make chemicals react together, for example. A Japanese team have managed to replace those electric pumps with heart cells. So this device is essentially a ball of silicone polymer. And on either side of it, you have a little bundle of heart cells. The whole thing is only about 5 millimetres in diameter. They stick little Teflon tubes in either side of this squeezy ball, and they find that as long as they keep feeding nutrients to the heart cells keep beating, and they can go for about 5 days continuously pumping fluid through this ball.
So as the heart cell can, or group of cells contracts, then this squashes the ball and therefore squeezes the tubes.
That's right, yeah. Now, it's one of the applications could be for moving liquids around these sorts of lab-on-a-chip devices. Looking further into the future, the researchers are suggesting that it may be useful in medical implants. Normally, if you have a pump working in your body, it will need a battery with it, and these need replacing. If you could have a system where it's relying on heart cells to actually do the squeezing of this ball, to do the pumping, in theory, they could last much longer and take up a lot less room as well.
But if you're using this as a kind of near-patient monitoring system just to have a lab on a chip, then really the size constraint is less important. So is it worth the practical application to do this with these cells?
Well, one of the things that people working on these labs on chips are trying to do is to try and bundle all the thing that you would normally get in a laboratory, all the huge big equipment, and try and get that all on one postage stamp sized chip, effectively. Now, it's all very well having that, but if you need a huge power device or a pumping mechanism stuck to the side, you lose the benefits of that miniaturisation. So this is just one more way that they're trying to cram everything that they need onto the size of a postage stamp.
The pace of technology, it all moves forward just in the space of one heartbeat. But talking about cancer now, and the morning after pill allegedly can prevent breast cancer, Victoria.
Yeah, that's right. The active ingredient, mifepristone, the active ingredient in the morning after pill, can prevent breast cancer development in quite a specific group of patients, patients with a susceptibility gene mutation in a gene called BRCA1. And these are a really small group of women at the moment, but these patients have to go through a very traumatic experience when they're diagnosed with this particular mutation, in that it's so high risk. If they have this mutation, they often undergo double mastectomies just to prevent themselves developing these cancers.
So how did researchers find that taking the morning after pill might actually offset that risk set by that gene?
Well, the crucial component is progesterone. Progesterone is a hormone that's very important in pregnancy, and mifepristone is a progesterone antagonist, which is how it works to cause basically a miniature abortion when you take the morning after pill as an emergency contraceptive. Now, the BRCA1 gene produces a protein which degrades progesterone receptors. If you degrade these progesterone receptors in these mammary cells, in these tumorous mammary cells, then the progesterone can't act upon them to cause the cells to proliferate. So it prevents cancer developing.
And are they planning to do some clinical trials? Because this sounds like a very important step forward for this subgroup of patients who carry these BRCA mutations.
It is, but at the moment, this is just work that's been done in the lab on mice with induced mammary tumours. So this comes from the University of California. So it's early stages now, but yeah, that will be the next step.
I guess it'll be interesting too, because the BRCA mutations aren't just associated with breast cancer, because they lead people to have an increased risk of things like ovarian cancer as well.
Yeah, exactly. So these are all things that can be investigated. And obviously, when you're dealing with an already approved drug, it's something that can be taken forward quite quickly.
Heartening news. Thanks, Victoria. And now we're off to the bottom of the sea with the University of Toronto's Steve Scott, who's searching for buried treasure. Now, it's not the stuff you'd associate with pirates, but in fact, concentrated deposits of ores that might be very cheap to exploit.
The deep sea occupies a big part of our planet. The oceans are 71% of our planet, and the deep sea is about 80% of that. So there's a lot of secrets in the deep ocean that we're just beginning to understand, and one of these is the hot springs on the deep ocean floor that are spewing out fluids at temperatures as high as 420 degrees centigrade. And in these fluids are dissolved metals, iron, but more interestingly, economically at least, copper, zinc, lead, silver, and gold that are precipitating around these hot springs on the seafloor and building up towering chimneys as much as 40 meters high that of course, are unstable, and they eventually fall over and produce accumulations of chimneys that grow into mounds and produce what, for all intents and purposes, are ore deposits on the ocean floor.
How abundant are those ores, Steve? How much of them is down there?
Well, there's about 350 sites that we know about now, and in total, thousands of these so-called hydrothermal vents or hot springs. Some of them are very small. Some of them would fit in somebody's dining room. Others are quite large. For example, the ones in the Bismarck Sea off the east coast of Papua New Guinea, some of those deposits measure a few hundred meters in diameter.
So are they actually exploitable? Because some people have suggested that these particular ore deposits are much more enriched than ore that we could get out of the ground normally in a normal mine or something, and therefore they might actually be worth a sort of pillaging to get the goodness out.
Yeah, I definitely think they are exploitable. At least the ones in the Manus Basin, this is actually a site that I discovered back in the 90s, our own sampling, plus the much more detailed sampling by a mining exploration group called Nautilus Minerals, has verified that this is incredibly rich. Now, they took a 15-ton bulk sample out of one of the deposits, and it averaged something like 5.2% copper and 6.6 grams per ton of gold. Now, a typical mine of this type on land, that in volcanic rocks, which we have around the world in various places, and lots of them in Canada, they would average maybe 2 to 4% copper and maybe a gram or two of ton of gold.
Is it actually economically viable to recover, though? Because whilst it may be richer, of course, you've got the added problem of a lot of seawater above you.
Yeah, you got a lot of seawater. The Manus Basin site, it's in 1,600 to 1,700 meters of water. But, you know, there are mines on land that are down 3,000 meters. For example, in Timmins, the Kidd Creek mine here in Canada. And it's a whole lot easier to go down through a couple of thousand meters of water than a couple of thousand meters of rock. All you have to do is put a pipe down there. Whereas on land, you've got to do an awful lot of blasting and drilling. It's very expensive to do.
Can you actually do a sort of environmental calculation to work out which is actually better for the planet in the long run? Is it better to go down to these pristine marine environments and exploit those, or is it better to do the drilling and blasting that you mentioned?
I personally think that, in fact, the ocean mining will be less an environmental problem than mining on land. And it's not a question of out of sight, out of mind, because, you know, no one will accept that. On land, you have to dig big holes in the ground. If you have an open cast mine, You've got to remove an awful lot of barren rock to get at the ore. You know, maybe for every ton of ore, you might have to move 5 to 10 tons of barren rock, and you have to put that rock somewhere. And you're going to leave a big hole behind in the ground. And when it rains, it produces acids from the breakdown of the iron sulfide, makes sulfuric acid, and creates acid mine drainage, which is a big problem. In fact, those are the three biggest problems for mining on land. In the oceans, you won't generate acid drainage because the oceans are alkaline, so you just simply don't generate the acids. There'll be no big holes in the seabed because these things are sitting like bumps on the seafloor. You're going to remove that bump. It's referred to as surgical mining. You take just the ore, and so you're not removing any waste rock. So the three biggest problems for mining on land don't exist in the oceans. The other environmental side of this is the biological side, and there it's different. I mean, on land, you're going to destroy some trees, maybe a few animals and so forth. In the deep ocean, there are ecosystems that are not terribly well understood. And, you know, I don't think anybody, including the companies who want to exploit these things, would want to be labeled as the destroyers of the only living example of something. And as a result, at least the one company called Nautilus Minerals that is exploiting or intending to exploit the Manus Basin site in 2009, they are have been actually for many months now carrying on a baseline environmental study using PhD biologists to do it.
Steve Scott. And sticking with that watery theme, a washing machine's got itself into hot water over nano regulations, Richard.
Well, apparently, Chris, yes. The US Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, were trumpeted as the first ever regulation on nanoparticles, and it was all down to a washing machine. The saga begins when a Samsung washing machine, which released silver ions into your clothes to kill bacteria, was classed as a pesticide by the EPA because, possibly, the silver ions could get out, could accumulate in wastewater treatment plants, might possibly kill bacteria that were meant to treat the wastewater.
But people have been using silver particles for thousands of years. The Egyptians sterilised their water with it, didn't they?
That's right, but we do know a bit more now about the toxicity of the silver dependent on its environmental concentrations. So all the EPA wanted to know was, well, you know, what is the exposure of silver? But that got turned into a regulation on nanoparticles because Samsung were marketing their washing machine as containing nano silver. Now, the EPA can't possibly really regulate nanoparticles because they can't ask questions of Samsung about the nano aspects, the aspects of the size and shape of the particles, rather than just asking about the silver aspects. And this is a general problem. There really isn't enough research into the basic health and safety aspects of nanoparticles to say what does a nanoparticle do that a particle of silver that's larger doesn't.
So are we looking at having, rather like we've got the biohazard sign at the moment, there'll be something similar constructed for nanohazards, and you'll have to stamp it on absolutely everything, I would think.
Well, unfortunately, a nanohazard sign would probably be entirely meaningless, and that's probably why we need more research into the different classes of nanoparticles and their effects. Many people have suggested that both US and the UK need to invest a lot more money into health and safety research and a lot less of a proportion into what nanoparticles can do.
So at the moment, do we actually have any of that in place? Or are people just generating nanoparticles willy-nilly for absolutely everything? I mean, they're in socks, aren't they? Odour-eating socks. Yeah. They're in various clothes. They're in other things to keep fridges sterile. Do we actually know what the consequences are? And are there any mechanisms in place to check them?
Well, at the moment, all the research that's being done, the US are throwing around $40 million this year into research groups independently looking at different aspects of nanoparticles. Andrew Maynard, the director of the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies in the US, told us that that was rather haphazard. There was no overall strategy. While the UK has got a lot of high-powered groups together, the Royal Academy of Engineering, Royal Society, but that's all rather slow. So they're taking a much more integrated approach, but they may never get to the end. But we may actually have our first nanoparticle regulation in Berkeley in the US. They have a small municipal regulation now that anyone working on nanoparticles has to survey the literature and report their nanoparticle exposures and so on. But that very much depends on what literature there is. And at the moment, there isn't enough.
And the fate of the washing machine?
As yet undecided, Samsung say they will cooperate with the EPA.
Thanks, Richard. And we'll be returning to the safety of nanoparticles, this time in the form of air pollution, later on in the podcast. But first, here's Sue Ferns from Prospect, the union that represents public sector scientists. In other words, scientists who work on issues like food safety, climate change, pollution and biodiversity. She's very worried that the erosion of funding and a poor career structure are threatening to jeopardise this key part of our infrastructure.
The core problem, as we see it, is that really nobody in government is taking a strategic overview of public sector science. So although there's some very good science going on, and we wouldn't want to say otherwise, and although government have invested in the science base, in fact, government departments are cutting back on their science budgets. The funding that is coming through, some of it's going into new facilities, which is fantastic, but those facilities are very expensive. And what we're concerned about is that there doesn't seem to be the same investment going through into the scientific staff, which, of course, are equally as important as having good facilities.
I suppose a cynic could argue that one should let market forces drive what's happening in the scientific world, though, shouldn't we?
Well, I think to some extent market forces do drive some science. However, what we're concerned about is that the science that simply won't be done if it's left to market forces. The kind of science I'm talking about there is long-term data gathering, for example, for climate change monitoring, also science in support of public policy. And also we do know from experience of BSE and the foot and mouth disease crises that the people in the front line in those times are public sector scientists, and the government needs to be able to call on them very quickly.
The figures don't make exciting reading, do they? I mean, in fact, they look really rather scary when your own study shows that 40% of scientists you asked said they will or might quit science.
Yes, well, our study also showed, however, that three-quarters of them actually wanted to stay in science, and very many of them are being forced out either through early retirement or redundancy because of budget pressures. But other scientists, perhaps coming in very enthusiastic as young scientists, which is what our survey seems to show, after they get onto their second or third fixed-term contract, they see there's no career progression, they very quickly get fed up and they realise that they can take their talents elsewhere.
But even more worrying, Sue, it must surely be the fact that the government doesn't even have a clue how many scientists, at least it would appear, they actually employ.
Absolutely, the government doesn't have a clue because we've asked them and we've asked questions in Parliament and they simply don't know that. They don't know how many scientists they employ, they don't know what their scientific capability is. And for us, that's hugely worrying, not just for today, but looking ahead in terms of the scientific challenges that UK is likely to face. Government can't actually say with any confidence that it has the scientists to meet those challenges.
But what do you think it's actually going to take in the workplace to convince these 40%, four people in every 10 who want to quit? What's going to convince them to stay?
What's going to convince them to stay is not having to spend one day of every working week bidding for funding. What will convince them to stay is if they had core funding, not had to compete for funding all the time. If they could look ahead with some certainty over 5 years rather than 18 months or so on, they need to have better pay. They need to have better career prospects. They need to be treated like the professionals they are.
Sue Ferns from Prospect. And you can read Sue's article about the problem in this month's Chemistry World. On the way, will new chemical legislation make Europe a safer place or just less viable for business? And out of sight and out of mind. Or not. We'll be taking a look at how nanoparticles in vehicle exhaust fumes may be a previously overlooked threat to our health. But first, Victoria, bacteria are now helping scientists to target tumours more effectively with anti-cancer drugs.
Exactly, a new meaning to friendly bacteria. This particularly exciting bacteria has a protein within it that can break open little packages that contain cancer-fighting drugs. Because one of the problems with chemotherapy is that although it's very effective at fighting cancer, it also causes a lot of collateral damage and is equally damaging to healthy tissue. So one of the things that cancer researchers have been doing is finding ways to package it to protect healthy tissue and deliver it specifically to tumours. And one of the things they can do to do that is package it inside liposomes, which are lipid membrane surrounded sort of water-filled capsules that you can put a soluble drug inside. But you then need to get into these little packages and deliver the drug at the site of the tumour. Now, this is where the bacteria comes in, because the bacteria Clostridium novae that they've used contains a protein that lyses or opens up these liposomes. But the really exciting thing about this particular Clostridium is that it selectively infects tumours, because it likes the anaerobic conditions of tumours. Tumours proliferate really quickly and they don't form a good, healthy vasculature, so they're very hypoxic. And this particular bacteria likes to live in tumours. So if you inject the bacterial spores at the same time as injecting these liposome encapsulated drugs, then they will pop open, but only within the tumours.
Is this in animals, or have they got this in people yet?
Well, it's moving pretty quickly, but at the moment, this data, these results come from mice. They've induced colon tumours, and they've managed to eradicate pretty much all of the tumours. It was something like 90% of these tumours were eradicated. They then wanted to look at how they were going to take this to the next stage without just injecting humans with bacteria, because there are a lot of side effects associated with injecting bacterial spores into people.
I can't see many people wanting to be injected with Clostridium, given that same family has got the bug that causes tetanus, another bug that causes gas gangrene, and
exactly.
The one that causes botulism in it.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to get a lot of nasty side effects. That's pretty much guaranteed. So what they've managed to do is they've isolated the protein that is doing the lysing. What they've found is that it's a new protein that they've not seen before. It's a new enzyme, and they've termed it liposomase, because it breaks open liposomes. So what they can do now is that they can take this liposomase, eradicate the need for these nasty bacterial spores that might cause all sorts of problems in people, and use this to break open liposome encapsulated drugs.
Thanks, Victoria. This is the Chemistry World podcast with me, Chris Smith. Now, if you've been listening to previous editions of this programme, you probably recall our report on the suspension of a study that DEFRA commissioned into the possible link between organophosphate-containing pesticides and ill health amongst farmers who used them. The study began in 2003, but it's encountered a number of problems tracking down a suitable control group of individuals. The team have come up with a number of possibilities, but they've all been rejected by the VMD, or Veterinary Medical Directorate. DEFRA have now allowed the study to continue, but the problem's far from solved. UCL researcher Sarah McKenzie-Ross is leading the study.
We are trying to do a study which is investigating whether low-level exposure to organophosphate pesticides is associated with ill health. And as part of the study, we wanted to recruit farmers who have worked with sheep dip over the years, but also we wanted what we refer to as a control group, which is a group of people who live very similar lives to farmers but haven't been exposed to pesticides. So initially, we hoped that we could find some sort of farming population, but this turned out to be impossible because it seems that all farmers, even organic farmers, have at some point in the past used pesticides. So we had to look at using alternative occupational groups, and we made several suggestions to DEFRA as to what might constitute a suitable comparison or control group.
What, and they weren't happy with that?
Well, DEFRA and ourselves thought that rural police might make a suitable comparison group. But when DEFRA asked advice from a scientific committee within the VMD, the scientific committee had very strong views on this issue and felt that the police wouldn't make a suitable control group.
And did they volunteer a more suitable alternative?
No, they didn't give us any alternatives. We came up with 12 possibilities in total, and it's quite easy to find fault with any one of the suggestions we made. And certainly the VMD had no difficulty finding fault with things, but they weren't very helpful in helping us find an alternative.
And have you now resolved that problem?
No, we haven't. Although DEFRA have agreed to continue funding us, they've said that we have to write a report finding an alternative control group from the one that we originally suggested and making a very strong argument for why it's suitable. And I don't know what they will do with that information once we've given it to them. Presumably it'll go back to the VMD and may well be criticised again.
Have there been any major consequences for your study as it's progressed, because it's been ongoing throughout this, hasn't it? What have been the impacts of this on the actual progression of the study?
There's two main impacts. Firstly, we wanted to start testing comparison subjects at the same time as farmers so that we could, when farmers are busy, we could get on with testing comparison subjects. But that hasn't been possible because we haven't agreed who the comparison subjects will be. So all in all, what it will mean is that this project will no doubt have to ask for an extension in order to be completed. So that's one outcome. The second more worrying outcome has been that a number of farmers have heard that our funding is under threat because of this issue. And so when they've been phoned up and asked to take part in the study, they've said to my researchers, oh, what's the point? They're probably going to pull the funding on your study. Why should I bother taking part? So we've lost participants.
And your message to DEFRA off the back of your experience would be what?
The main issue in terms of control groups is that because there isn't a farming population that hasn't been exposed, you have to use an alternative occupational group. And any occupational group you can criticise on some level because they don't look exactly like farmers. But the main important point is they only need to be matched on variables that might affect the measures that we're using. So really we just need to find a group of people who have of similar age, live in a rural location, similar gender and similar level of intelligence to the farmers that we're testing. Those are the only things that matter. It doesn't really matter whether they're police or postal workers or shopkeepers.
Sarah Mackenzie Ross, and I'm sure we'll be returning to that story sometime in the future. Now to the safety of chemicals used in Europe. REACH is the acronym, but what does it stand for and what does it mean for industry, Mark?
REACH is the largest and most complicated piece of legislation that's ever come out of the European Union. It also stands for the Registration, Evaluation, Authorisation and Restriction of Chemicals. Now, don't turn off. Honestly, it is important and it's actually quite interesting. Up until now, we've had this hodgepodge of about 40 different acts which has overseen how chemicals manufacturers can move around and sell their chemicals. Some are more dangerous than others, bad for the environment, bad for health, but this has really not been terribly joined up, and it's tended to over-regulate for newer compounds, but not pay enough attention to those that have been in use for decades.
Which may be equally as destructive.
Which may be equally as destructive, who knows? And the lack of data on those older compounds has been one of the things that's been driving REACH. European politicians have been debating about this for more than 3 years, with a lot of lobbying going on from both the chemical industry and environmental campaigners, trying to work out an alternative to the existing system. And what they've come up with is REACH. Essentially, what it's doing is putting the onus on determining how safe chemicals are back onto the chemical industry themselves. So rather than government agencies going out and saying, let's test these chemicals to see whether they're bad or good, it's up to industry to provide that safety data.
But to do that, you need massive, great epidemiological studies. You need thousands of study participants. You need really good records. You need very careful evaluation to work out over a period of time whether something does have nasty side effects. So is that doable by average industry?
Well, that's right. One of the issues is, of course, how do you determine whether something is safe enough? What level do you cut off at? Do you just do some animal studies or do you look at the effect on populations of 60,000 or more? And in a sense, what's going to happen is it depends on what people already know about the risks of these chemicals.
Is that what they're really expecting companies to do? To commission animal studies and then human trials to see if this average chemical that they want to put in their plastic bottles is safe?
One of the problems with the existing system is that a lot of this data already exists. It's just that because of the proprietary nature, if you like, the fact that this is all intellectual property, there's not been an awful lot of data sharing. So one of the things that REACH is trying to do is to ensure that that epidemiological data, the animal study data, gets shared around freely between industry so that there's less duplication. Ultimately, although the EU expect there to be a small rise in animal testing over the first few years of REACH, ultimately they hope that this data sharing will severely reduce the amount of animal testing that needs to go on.
On the other hand, if they make the climate here too anti, if they restrict the climate here too much, won't you see people moving to a country where REACH doesn't extend its reach, if you like, and therefore people will go abroad and do their work?
A lot of industry lobbyists have said that this will be the outcome. It's quite funny, actually. Industry say that the regulations are far too stringent. Environmentalists say that it doesn't go nearly far enough. But one of the arguments is, as you said, that if you set up too much regulation where it's actually very expensive to get a chemical approved for sale or use, use within the EU? Because this will cover, to some extent, imports of chemicals into Europe for use as well from outside of the EU. The fear is among industry that investors looking to put capital into a new manufacturing plant, for example, will say, well, actually, it's going to be simply easier for us to make that plant in China or India, where the regulations are perhaps less stringent. To be honest, only time will tell. REACH is being phased in over the next 11 years up until 2017, so it's going to be at least a decade before the full impact of this is felt.
Thanks, Mark. Over to the pharmaceutical industry now and the collapse of a top-tipped clinical trial. Derek Lowe is a medicinal chemist and is also the editor of the drug discovery website In the Pipeline.
What I've written about is one of the worst clinical failures to occur in the drug industry in many years, which is quite a competition because we've had some especially bad ones over the last few years, but this was one of the most anticipated drug launches, especially by Pfizer, because they're trying to replace the biggest selling drug ever, Lipitor, and they had what they thought could have been a new record holder for the biggest selling drug ever. On Thursday of the week, they came out and talked about how great things were going, and on Saturday, the drug was gone.
What actually is that drug? How does it work, and why is it thought to be such a prize chalice to the drug industry?
Well, the drug is called torcetrapib, and the idea was that this would raise HDL, the so-called good cholesterol. Lipitor and the other statins all lower LDL, the bad cholesterol, so this was a natural companion piece. There are a number of other companies that have been working on drugs to raise HDL, but torcetrapib was by far the furthest along and was going to be the proof of concept for the entire area.
And it was in phase 3, was it?
It was.
And what actually went wrong, and why did they subsequently decide to withdraw it?
Well, the earlier studies had looked good. They showed that the mechanism seemed to be working. HDL was coming up. And there was one worry, though. There was a slight rise in blood pressure in the patients getting the drug. So that was a cloud on the horizon. But what happened was Pfizer expanded to a larger trial, as you do in phase 3, and what they found was that the death rate in the drug treatment group was significantly higher than the placebo group. And, of course, that immediately put the brakes on the entire project.
Pfizer aren't the only company that are producing drugs which are targeted at this particular enzyme, the CETP, the cholesterol ester transfer protein. Other companies are too. So has this put the kibosh on other companies then?
Oh, they would certainly like to know that. Roche, for example, has a compound they licensed in from Japan, from JTT, and that is the second furthest along, and Merck is understood to be working in the area as well. The complication is that these three compounds may be acting on CETP slightly differently. So the big question is it a mechanistic problem? Anything you do to CETP will cause this? Or can you hit CETP in a slightly different way? And honestly, no one knows yet, and I can tell you, I'm sure the people at Roche and Merck are just holding their breath trying to find out.
I think you put it very well when you say it's like making a living by staggering blindly around in a casino, waving a wad of cash in one hand and a fistful of test tubes in the other. That must be how they feel, because they've got no option now but to go ahead and explore the compounds because they've taken it so far, and they can't wind it up because the outcome actually might be okay.
Exactly. It's like Macbeth, you know, should I step no more, returning where as tedious as go o'er. They really have no choice. It's quite an industry to make a living in, I can tell you.
But from a clinical point of view, what do you think the ramifications of the failure have been?
Well, they've really made people think about HDL. Clearly, the idea that just raising HDL is across the board a good thing is too simplistic. We should have learned this lesson before, because every time we go into the clinic, we find out things aren't as simple as we thought. But the human lipid profile has just been getting more and more difficult to understand with every advance we make in the field. And now it's HDL's turn. There's something else going on there that we have to figure out.
Derek Lowe commenting on the collapse of the torcetrapib trial, which was Pfizer's drug destined to raise HDL, the good cholesterol in the blood. Right, back to nanoparticles now. And the question on everyone's lips is, what's coming out of your exhaust pipe, Richard?
Well, Chris, this refers to quite an interesting study done by researchers at Leeds. They went to a roadside in Leeds and they measured the particle concentrations in the air in rush hour traffic. And interestingly, they found that those particles were a lot smaller than you might have thought. In fact, the number of particles in the air was really dominated by small nanoparticles.
Didn't we know this already? I mean, we know that diesel, whilst being highly efficient as a fuel, is actually quite savage for your lungs, isn't it?
Yeah, we did know this, but we tend to regulate what's called PM10s, particles of around 10 microns or less. Nanoparticles were a lot smaller than that. And at the moment, legislation on air quality tends to go on the sort of mass of particles that you find in the air. But the Leeds researchers point out that nanoparticles don't make up much mass in the air. They're very light, maybe only 1 to 20%. But they make up 90% of the volume of particle in the air. They've got such a large surface area, and the nanoparticles are the ones that might do damage even more than the micron-sized particles.
Had we just not looked for them before, then?
I don't think the extent of the amount of nanoparticles in the air had been appreciated before. This is a very preliminary study.
And what do they say the bottom line is? Do they think these things could harm health?
Well, nanoparticles can actually get into your lung, penetrate deeply, and cross over possibly into your bloodstream, which micron-sized particles might not be able to. So there is that danger, but we simply don't really have the safety research.
So you're urging more of a look-see to find out what the consequences are?
That's right, yeah. The Leeds researchers want more details into the consequences, more details on what's in our air, and possibly a change in the way we think about the mass or the volume of particles in the air.
Because people have looked in the past at the stickiness of blood on high pollution days, and we find that heart attacks go up on days when air pollution and air quality is bad. This could be a part of that.
That's right, it could be. They did actually find that when they looked at the particles in the air during the day, during the rush hour afternoon, the vehicle emissions were dominated by larger particles. But in the morning, when the sun was shining, they found that nanoparticles were actually made by photolysis and were much smaller. So actually, depending on different times of the day and different formation mechanisms, you can actually get different sizes of particles in the air. None of this really appreciated before.
Thanks, Richard. And now back to Mary's question, which was, when Christmas crackers were invented, what made them go bang? To explode the story for us, here's Edinburgh University's Colin Pullum.
The original Christmas cracker, complete with loud bang, was developed by a London-based confectioner called Tom Smith in 1860. It's actually proved quite difficult to track down the precise nature of the chemical mixture used in the early crackers. However, one source suggests that saltpeter, or potassium nitrate, was used. Now, potassium nitrate is an oxidising agent that is used in gunpowder, and when combined with a fuel such as sulphur, carbon or sugar, it provides the oxygen necessary for rapid combustion of these fuels. This results in rapid release of gases such as sulphur dioxide, carbon dioxide and steam, and hence a loud bang. Another possibility is that Tom used a mixture based on a type of match commonly used at the time, known as lucifers. These matches contain potassium chlorate and antimony sulphide mixed with a little gum, and could be ignited by friction, e.g. rubbing against sandpaper. They were also reported to give a loud bang when struck. In this reaction, potassium chlorate acts as an oxidising agent, and the products of the reaction are sulphur dioxide, potassium chloride and antimony oxide. Modern-day crackers generally contain very small amounts of a compound called silver fulminate, formula AgOCN. Silver fulminate is termed an endothermic compound and is also very sensitive to shock or friction. When set off in a cracker, it decomposes rapidly to give silver, gaseous nitrogen, and oxides of carbon. Silver fulminate is also found in so-called throw-down snaps. These are the twists of paper containing grit coated with silver fulminate. When these are thrown at hard surfaces, friction sets off the fulminate, and we get a loud bang.
So it all started with the confectionery trade. I wonder if that's where the saying business is booming comes from. We've got a painful question to tackle this month. It's from Petro.
I'd just like to know, why are bruises the colour they are, and why do they change colour over time?
So if you can help us with that, then please drop a line to chemistryworld@rsc.org, and you can also use that address if you'd like to send us any feedback. That's it for this month's edition, which was produced and presented by me, Chris Smith, from thenakedscientist.com, with Chemistry World editor Mark Peplow and science correspondents Victoria Gill and Richard Van Norden. For more science in the meantime, do check out the Chemistry World website at chemistryworld.org. I'll be back next month. Until then, goodbye.